This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Schopenhauer Cure, a novel by Irvin D. Yalom. Narrated by Neil Heligers. 1. Every breath we draw wards off the death that constantly impinges on us. Ultimately, death must triumph, for by birth it has already become our lot, and it plays with its prey only for a short while before swallowing it up. However, we continue our life with great interest and much solicitude as long as possible, just as we blow out a soap bubble as long and as large as possible, although with the perfect certainty that it will burst. Julius knew the life and death homilies as well as anyone. He agreed with the Stoics, who said, "As soon as we are born, we begin to die." And with Epicurus, who reasoned, "Where I am, death is not, and where death is, I am not. Hence why fear death?" As a physician and a psychiatrist, he had murmured these very consolations into the ears of the dying. Though he believed these somber reflections to be useful to his patients, he never considered that they might have anything to do with him. That is, until a terrible moment 4 weeks earlier, which forever changed his life. The moment occurred during his annual routine physical examination. His internist, Herb Katz, an old friend and medical school classmate, had just completed his examination and, as always, told Julius to dress and come to his office for a debriefing. Herb sat at his desk, rifling through Julius's chart. "On the whole, you look pretty good for an ugly 65-year-old man. Prostate is getting a little swollen, but so is mine. Blood chemistries, cholesterol, and lipid levels are well-behaved. The meds in your diet are doing their job. Here's the prescription for your Lipitor, which, along with your jogging, has lowered your cholesterol enough. So you can give yourself a break, eat an egg once in a while. I eat two for breakfast every Sunday. And here's the prescription for your Synthroid. I'm raising the dose a bit. Your thyroid gland is slowly closing down, the good thyroid cells are dying and being replaced by a fibrotic material. Perfectly benign condition, as you know. Happens to us all. I am on thyroid meds myself." Yes, Julius, no part of us escapes the destiny of aging. "Along with your thyroid, your knee cartilage is wearing out, your hair follicles are dying, and your upper lumbar discs are not what they used to be. What's more, your skin integrity is obviously deteriorating. Your epithelial cells are just plain wearing out. Look at all those senile keratoses on your cheeks. Those brown, flat lesions." He held up a small mirror for Julius to inspect himself. "Must be a dozen more on you since I last saw you. How much time are you spending in the sun? Are you wearing a broad-brimmed hat like I suggested? I want you to see a dermatologist about them. Bob King's good. He's just in the next building. Here's his number. Know him?" Julius nodded. "He can burn off the unseemly ones with a drop of liquid nitrogen. I had him remove several of mine last month. No big deal, takes 5-10 minutes. A lot of internists are doing it themselves now. Also, there's one I want him to look at on your back. You can't see it, it's just under the lateral part of your right scapula. It looks different from the others. Pigmented unevenly and the borders aren't sharp. Probably nothing. But let's have him check it. Okay, buddy?" "Probably nothing. But let's have him check it." Julius heard the strain and forced casualness in Herb's voice. But let there be no mistake. The phrase, "pigmented differently and borders aren't sharp," spoken by one doc to another, was a cause for alarm. It was code for potential melanoma. And now, in retrospect, Julius identified that phrase, that singular moment, as the point when carefree life ended, and death, his heretofore invisible enemy, materialized in all its awful reality. Death had come to stay. It never again left his side. And all the horrors that followed were predictable postscripts. Bob King had been a patient of Julius's years ago, as had a significant number of San Francisco physicians. Julius had reigned over the psychiatric community for 30 years. In his position as professor of psychiatry at the University of California, he had trained scores of students and, 5 years before, had been president of the American Psychiatric Association. His reputation? A no-bullshit doctor's doctor. A therapist of last resort. A canny wizard willing to do anything he had to help his patient. And that was the reason why, 10 years earlier, Bob King had consulted Julius for treatment of his long-standing addiction to Vicodin, the physician addict's drug of choice because it is so easily accessible. At that time, King was in serious trouble. His Vicodin needs had dramatically increased, his marriage was in jeopardy, his practice was suffering, and he had to drug himself to sleep every night. Bob tried to enter therapy, but all doors were closed for him. Every therapist he consulted insisted that he enter an impaired physician recovery program, a plan which Bob resisted because he was loath to compromise his privacy by attending therapy groups with other physician addicts. The therapist wouldn't budge. If they treated a practicing addicted physician without using the official recovery program, they would place themselves at risk of punitive action by the medical board or of personal litigation. If, for example, the patient made an error of judgment in clinical work. As a last resort before quitting his practice and taking a leave of absence to be treated anonymously in another city, he appealed to Julius, who accepted the risk and trusted Bob King to withdraw on his own from Vicodin. And though therapy was difficult, as it always is with addicts, Julius treated Bob for the next 3 years without the help of a recovery program. And it was one of those secrets that every psychiatrist had. A therapeutic success that could in no way be discussed or published. Julius sat in his car after leaving his internist's office. His heart pounded so hard the car seemed to shake. Taking a deep breath to quell his mounting terror, then another and another, he opened his cell phone and, with trembling hands, called Bob King for an urgent appointment. "I don't like it," said Bob the next morning as he studied Julius's back with a large round magnifying glass. "Here, I want you to look at it. We can do it with two mirrors." Bob stationed him by the wall mirror and held a large hand mirror next to the mole. Julius glanced at the dermatologist through the mirror, blonde, ruddy-faced, thick spectacles resting on his long, imposing nose. He remembered Bob telling him how the other kids taunted him with cries of cucumber nose. He hadn't changed much in 10 years. He looked harried, much as when he'd been Julius's patient, huffing and puffing, always arriving a few minutes late. The white rabbit's refrain, I'm late for a very important date, often had come to mind when Bob rushed into his office. He had gained weight, but was as short as ever. He looked like a dermatologist. Whoever saw a tall dermatologist? Then Julius glanced at his eyes. Uh-oh, they seemed apprehensive. The pupils were large. "Here's the critter." Julius looked through the mirror as Bob pointed with an eraser-tip stylus. "This flat nevus below your right shoulder under your scapula. See it?" Julius nodded. Holding a small ruler to it, he continued, "It's a shade less than 1 centimeter. I'm sure you remember the ABCD rule of thumb from your med school dermatology." Julius interrupted. "I don't remember squat from medical school dermatology. Treat me like a dummy." "Okay. ABCD. A is for asymmetry. Look here." He moved the stylus to parts of the lesion. It's not perfectly round like all these others on your back. See this one and this one. He pointed to two nearby small moles. Julius tried to break his tension by taking a deep breath. B for borders. Now, look here, I know it's hard to see. Bob pointed again to the subscapular lesion. See in this upper area how sharp the border is? But all around here on the medial side, it's indistinct. Just fades into the surrounding skin. C for coloration. Here on this side, see how it's light brown. If I magnify it, I see a tad of red, some black, maybe even some gray. D for diameter. As I say, perhaps 7/8 of a centimeter. That's good sized, but we can't be sure how old it is. I mean, how fast it's growing. Herb Katz says it wasn't there at last year's physical. Lastly, under magnification, there is no doubt that the center is ulcerated. Putting down the mirror, he said, "Put your shirt back on, Julius." After his patient finished buttoning up, King sat down on a small stool in the examining room and began, "Now, Julius, you know the literature on this. The concerns are obvious." "Look, Bob," replied Julius. "I know our previous relationship makes this hard for you, but please don't ask me to do your work. Don't assume I know anything about this. Keep in mind that right now my state of mind is terror veering toward panic. I want you to take charge, to be entirely honest with me, and take care of me, just as I did for you. And Bob, look at me. When you avoid my gaze like that, it scares the shit out of me." "Right. Sorry." He looked him straight in the eyes. "You took damn good care of me. I'll do the same for you." He cleared his throat. "Okay. My strong clinical impression is that it's a melanoma." Noting Julius's wince, he added, "Even so, the diagnosis itself tells you little. Most, remember that, most melanomas are easily treated, though some are bitches. We need to know some things from the pathologist. Is it melanoma for certain? If so, how deep is it? Has it spread? So first step is biopsy and getting a specimen to the pathologist. Soon as we finish, I'll call a general surgeon to excise the lesion. I'll be by his side throughout. Next, an examination of a frozen section by the pathologist, and if it's negative, then great, we're finished. If it's positive, if it is a melanoma, we'll remove the most suspicious node, or if necessary, do a multiple node resection. No hospitalization required, the whole procedure will be done in a surgery center. I'm pretty sure no skin graft will be needed, and at most, you will miss only a day of work. But you'll feel some discomfort at the surgical site for a few days. Nothing else to say now until we learn more from the biopsy. As you asked, I'll take care of you. Trust my judgment on this. I've been involved with hundreds of these cases, okay? My nurse will call you later today with all the details about time and place and prep instruction, okay?" Julius nodded. They both rose. "I'm sorry," Bob said. "I wish I could spare you all this, but I can't." He held out a folder of reading material. "I know you may not want this stuff, but I always distribute it to patients in your situation. Depends on the person. Some are comforted by information. Others would rather not know and just toss it out on the way out of the office. Hope after the surgery to tell you something brighter." But there was never to be anything brighter. The later news was darker yet. 3 days after the biopsy procedure, they met again. "Do you want to read this?" said Bob, holding out the final pathologist report. Seeing Julius shake his head, Bob scanned the report again and began, "Okay, let's go over it. I gotta tell you, it's not good. Bottom line is that it is a melanoma, and it has several, notable characteristics. It's deep, over 4 millimeters, ulcerated. And there are 5 positive nodes. Meaning? Come on, Bob, don't talk around this. Notable, 4 millimeters, ulcerated, 5 nodes. Be straight. Talk to me as if I were a layman. Meaning, bad news. It's a sizable melanoma, and it has spread to the nodes. The real danger here is more distant spread, but we won't know that till the CT scan, which I've arranged for tomorrow at 8. 2 days later, they continued their discussion. Bob reported that the CT scan was negative. No evidence of spread elsewhere in the body. That was the first good news. But even so, Julius, this adds up to a dangerous melanoma. How dangerous? Julius's voice cracked. What are we talking about? What kind of survival rate? You know we can only address that question in terms of statistics. Everyone is different. But for an ulcerated melanoma, 4 millimeters deep with 5 nodes, the statistical charts show a 5-year survival of less than 25%. Julius sat for several moments with head bowed, heart pounding, tears in his eyes before asking, "Keep going. You're being straight. I need to know what to tell my patients. What will my course be like? What's going to happen?" "It's impossible to be precise because nothing more will happen to you until the melanoma recurs somewhere in the body. When it does, especially if it metastasizes, then the course might be quick, perhaps weeks or months. As for your patients, hard to say. But it would not be unreasonable to hope for at least a year of good health ahead of you." Julius nodded slowly, head down. "Where's your family, Julius? Shouldn't you have brought someone in with you? I think you know about my wife's death 10 years ago. My son is on the East Coast, and my daughter is in Santa Barbara. I've said nothing to them yet. I didn't see any sense in disrupting their lives unnecessarily. I generally do better licking my wounds in private anyway. But I'm pretty sure that my daughter will come up immediately. Julius, I'm so sorry to have to tell you all this. Let me end with a little good news. There's a lot of energetic research going on now. Perhaps a dozen very active labs in this country and abroad. For unknown reasons, the incidence of melanoma has risen, almost doubled in the last 10 years, and it's a hot research area. It's possible that breakthroughs are close at hand. For the next week, Julius lived in a daze. Evelyn, his daughter, a classics professor, canceled her classes and drove up immediately to spend several days with him. He spoke at length to her, his son, his sister and brother, and to intimate friends. He often woke in terror at 3 a.m., crying out, gasping for air. He canceled his hours with his individual patients and with his therapy group for 2 weeks and spent hours pondering what and how to tell them. The mirror told him he didn't look like a man who had reached the end of his life. His 3-mile daily jog had kept his body young and wiry without an ounce of fat. Around his eyes and mouth, a few wrinkles, not many. His father had died with none at all. He had green eyes. Julius had always been proud of that. Strong and sincere eyes. Eyes that could be trusted. Eyes that could hold anyone's gaze. Young eyes. The eyes of the 16-year-old Julius. The dying man and the 16-year-old gazed at each other across the decades. He looked at his lips. Full, friendly lips. Lips that, even now in his time of despair, were on the edge of a warm grin. He had a full head of unruly black curly hair, graying only in the sideburns. When he was a teenager in the Bronx, the old white-haired, red-faced, anti-Semitic barber, whose tiny shop was down his street between Meyer's candy store and Morris's butcher shop, cursed his tough hair as he tugged at it with a steel comb and cut it with thinning shears. And now, Meyer, Morris, and the barber were all dead. And little 16-year-old Julius was on death's call sheet. One afternoon, he tried to attain some sense of mastery by reading the melanoma literature in the medical school library. But that proved futile. Worse than futile. It made things more horrendous. As Julius apprehended the truly ghastly nature of his disease, he began to think of melanoma as a voracious creature sinking ebony tendrils deep into his flesh. How startling it was to realize that suddenly he was no longer the supreme life form. Instead, he was a host. He was nourishment. Food for a fitter organism whose gobbling cells divided at a dizzying pace. An organism that blitzkrieged and annexed adjacent protoplasm, and was now undoubtedly outfitting clusters of cells for cruises into the bloodstream and colonization of distant organs. Perhaps the sweet, friable feeding grounds of his liver or the spongy, grassy meadows of his lungs. Julius put aside the reading. Over a week had gone by, and it was time to move past distraction. The hour had come to face what was really happening. "Sit down, Julius," he told himself. "Sit down and meditate upon dying." He closed his eyes. "So, death," he thought, "has finally made its appearance on stage. But what a banal entrance. The curtains jerked open by a roly-poly dermatologist with a cucumber nose, magnifying glass in hand, and costumed in white hospital coat with his name stitched in dark blue letters upon his upper breast pocket. And the closing scene? Destined, most likely, to be equally banal. His costume would be his wrinkled, pinstripe New York Yankees nightshirt with DiMaggio's number 5 on the back. The stage set? The same queen-size bed in which he had slept for 30 years, crumpled clothes in the chair beside the bed, and upon his bedside table, a stack of unread novels, unaware that their time would now never come. A whimpering, disappointing finale. Surely, Julius thought, the glorious adventure of his life deserves something more... more... more what? A scene he had witnessed a few months ago on a Hawaiian vacation came to mind. While hiking, he had quite by chance come upon a large Buddhist retreat center and saw a young woman walking through a circular labyrinth constructed of small lava stones. Reaching the center of the labyrinth, she stopped and remained motionless in a lengthy standing meditation. Julius's knee-jerk reaction to such religious ritual was not charitable, generally falling somewhere in the territory between ridicule and revulsion. But now, as he thought about that meditating young woman, he experienced softer feelings. A flood of compassion for her and for all his fellow humans who are victims of that freakish twist of evolution that grants self-awareness, but not the requisite psychological equipment to deal with the pain of transient existence. And so, throughout the years, the centuries, the millennia, we have relentlessly constructed makeshift denials of finiteness. Would we, would any of us, ever be done with our search for a higher power with whom we can merge and exist forever? For God-given instruction manuals? For some sign of a larger established design? For ritual and ceremony? And yet, considering his name on death's roster, Julius wondered whether a little ceremony might not be such a bad thing. He jerked away from his own thought as if scorched. So thoroughly dissonant was it with his lifelong antagonism to ritual. He had always despised the tools by which religions strip their followers of reason and freedom. The ceremonial robes, incense, holy books, mesmerizing Gregorian chants, prayer wheels, prayer rugs, shawls and skullcaps, bishops' mitres and croziers, holy wafers and wines, Last rites, heads bobbing and bodies swaying to ancient chants, all of which he considered the paraphernalia of the most powerful and longest-running con game in history. A game which empowered the leaders and satisfied the congregation's lust for submission. But now, with death standing next to him, Julius noted that his vehemence had lost its bite. Maybe it was simply imposed ritual that he disliked. Perhaps a good word could be found for a little personal creative ceremony. He was touched by the newspaper descriptions of the firemen at Ground Zero in New York, stopping, standing, and removing hats to honor the dead, as each pallet of newly discovered remains was brought to the surface. Nothing wrong with honoring the dead. No, not the dead, but honoring the life of the one who died. Or was it something more than honoring, more than sanctifying? Wasn't the gesture, the ritual of the firemen, also signifying connectivity? The recognition of their relationship, their unity with each victim. Julius had a personal taste of connectivity a few days after his fateful meeting with his dermatologist, when he attended a support group of fellow psychotherapists. His fellow doctors were stunned when Julius revealed the news of his melanoma. After encouraging him to talk himself out, each group member expressed his shock and sorrow. Julius couldn't find any more words, nor could anyone else. A couple of times someone started to talk, but did not. And then it was as if the group agreed non-verbally that words were not necessary. For the final 20 minutes, all sat in silence. Such prolonged silences in groups were almost invariably awkward. But this one felt different, almost comforting. Julius was embarrassed to admit, even to himself, that the silence felt sacred. Later it occurred to him that the members not only were expressing grief, but were also removing their hats, standing at attention, joining and honoring his life. And perhaps this was a way of honoring their own lives, Julius thought. What else do we have? What else other than this miraculous, blessed interval of being and self-awareness? If anything is to be honored and blessed, it should simply be this, the priceless gift of sheer existence. To live in despair because life is finite or because life has no higher purpose or embedded design is crass ingratitude. To dream up an omniscient creator and devote our life to endless genuflection seems pointless. And wasteful, too. Why squander all that love on a phantasm when there seems too little love to go around on Earth as it is? Better to embrace Spinoza's and Einstein's solution. Simply bow one's head, tip one's hat to the elegant laws and mystery of nature, and go about the business of living. These were not new thoughts for Julius. He had always known of finiteness and the evanescence of consciousness. But there is knowing and knowing. And death's presence on the stage brought him closer to really knowing. It was not that he had grown wiser. It was only that the removal of distractions, ambition, sexual passion, money, prestige, applause, popularity, offered a purer vision. Wasn't such detachment the Buddhist's truth? Perhaps so. But he preferred the path of the Greeks. Everything in moderation. Too much of life's show is missed if we never take off our coats and join in the fun. Why rush to the exit door before closing time? After a few days, when Julius felt calmer with fewer sweeps of panic, his thoughts turned to the future. 1 good year, Bob King had said. No guarantees, but it would not be unreasonable to hope for at least a year of good health. but how to spend that year. One thing he resolved was not to make that one good year a bad year by grieving that it was not more than a year. One night, unable to sleep and craving some comfort, he restlessly browsed in his library. He could find nothing written in his own field that seemed even remotely relevant to his life situation, nothing pertaining to how one should live, or find meaning in one's remaining days. But then his eye fell upon a dog-eared copy of Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra. Julius knew this book well. Decades ago, he had thoroughly studied it while writing an article on the significant but unacknowledged influence of Nietzsche on Freud. Zarathustra was a brave book which, more than any other, Julius thought, teaches how to revere and celebrate life. Yes, this might be the ticket. Too anxious to read systematically, he flipped the pages randomly and sampled some of the lines he had highlighted. To change it was into thus I willed it. That alone shall I call redemption. Julius understood Nietzsche's words to mean that he had to choose his life. He had to live it rather than be lived by it. In other words, he should love his destiny. Above all, there was Zarathustra's oft-repeated question whether we would be willing to repeat the precise life we had lived again and again throughout eternity. A curious thought experiment. Yet the more he thought about it, the more guidance it provided. Nietzsche's message to us was to live life in such a way that we would be willing to repeat the same life eternally. He continued flipping the pages and stopped at two passages highlighted heavily in neon pink. Consummate your life. Die at the right time. These hit home. Live your life to the fullest, and then, and only then, die. Don't leave any unlived life behind. Julius often likened Nietzsche's words to a Rorschach exam. They offered so many opposing viewpoints that the reader's state of mind determined what they took from them. Now he read with a vastly different state of mind. The presence of death prompted a different and more enlightened reading. In page after page, he saw evidence of pantheistic connectedness not previously appreciated. However much Zarathustra extolled, even glorified solitude, however much he required isolation in order to give birth to great thoughts, he was nonetheless committed to loving and lifting others, to helping others perfect and transcend themselves, to sharing his ripeness. Sharing his ripeness. That hit home. Returning Zarathustra to its resting place, Julius sat in the dark staring at the lights of cars crossing the Golden Gate Bridge and thinking about Nietzsche's words. After a few minutes, Julius came to. He knew exactly what to do and how to spend his final year. He would live just the way he had lived the previous year, and the year before that, and before that. He loved being a therapist. He loved connecting to others and helping to bring something to life in them. Maybe his work was sublimation for his lost connection to his wife. Maybe he needed the applause, the affirmation, and gratitude of those he helped. Even so, even if dark motives played their role, he was grateful for his work. God bless it. Strolling over to his wall of file cabinets, Julius opened a drawer filled with charts and audiotape sessions of patients seen long ago. He stared at the names, each chart a monument to a poignant human drama that had once played itself out in this very room. As he surfed through the charts, most of the faces immediately sprang to mind. Others had faded, but a few paragraphs of notes evoked their faces too. A few were the truly forgotten, their faces and stories lost forever. Like most therapists, Julius found it difficult to seal himself off from the unremitting attacks on the field of therapy. Assault came from many directions, from pharmaceutical companies and managed care, which sponsored superficial research orchestrated to validate the effectiveness of drugs and briefer therapies, from the media, which never tired of ridiculing therapists, from behaviorists, from motivational speakers, from the hordes of New Age healers and cults all competing for the hearts and minds of the troubled. And of course, there were doubts from within. The extraordinary molecular neurobiological discoveries reported with ever-increasing frequency caused even the most experienced therapists to wonder about the relevance of their work. Julius was not immune to these attacks and often entertained doubts about the effectiveness of his therapy and just as often soothed and reassured himself. Of course he was an effective healer. Of course he offered something valuable to most, perhaps even all, of his patients. Yet the imp of doubt continued to make its presence known. Were you really, truly helpful to your patients? Maybe you've just learned to pick patients who are going to improve on their own anyway. No, wrong. Wasn't I the one who always took on great challenges? Huh, you've got your limits. When was the last time you really stretched yourself, took a flagrant borderline into therapy, or a seriously impaired schizophrenic or a bipolar patient? Continuing to thumb through old charts, Julius was surprised to see how much post-therapy information he had. From occasional follow-up or tune-up visits, from chance encounters with the patient, or from messages delivered by new patients they'd referred to him. But still, had he made an enduring difference to them? Maybe his results were evanescent. Maybe many of his successful patients had relapsed and shielded that information from him out of sheer charity. He noted his failures, too. Folks, he had always told himself, who were not ready for his advanced brand of deliverance. Wait, he told himself. Give yourself a break, Julius. How do you know they were really failures? Permanent failures. You never saw them again. We all know there are plenty of late bloomers out there. His eye fell upon Philip Slate's thick chart. You want failure? He said to himself. There was failure. Old-time major league failure. Philip Slate. More than 20 years had passed, but his image of Philip Slate was crisp. His light brown hair combed straight back, his thin, graceful nose, those high cheekbones that suggested nobility, and those crisp green eyes that reminded him of Caribbean waters. He remembered how much he disliked everything about his sessions with Philip, except for one thing: the pleasure of looking at that face. Philip Slate was so alienated from himself that he never thought to look within, preferring to skate on the surface of life and devote all his vital energy to fornication. Thanks to his pretty face, he had no end of volunteers. Julius shook his head as he rifled through Philip's chart. 3 years of sessions. All that relating and support and caring, all those interpretations without a whisper of progress. Amazing. Perhaps he wasn't the therapist he thought he was. Whoa, don't jump to conclusions, he told himself. Why would Philip continue for 3 years if he had gotten nothing? Why would he continue to spend all that money for nothing? God knows, Philip hated to spend money. Maybe those sessions had changed Philip. Maybe he was a late bloomer. One of those patients who needed time to digest the nourishment given by the therapist. One of those who stored up some of the therapist's good stuff, took it home, like a bone to gnaw on later, in private. Julius had known patients so competitive that they hid their improvement just because they didn't want to give the therapist the satisfaction and the power of having helped them. Now that Philip Slate had entered his mind, Julius could not get him out. He had burrowed in and taken root, just like the melanoma. His failure with Philip became a symbol embodying all his failures in therapy. There was something peculiar about the case of Philip Slate. From where had it drawn all that power? Julius opened his chart and read his first note written 25 years before. Philip Slate, December 11th, 1980. 26-year-old single white male chemist working for DuPont, develops new pesticides. Strikingly handsome, carelessly dressed but has a regal air, formal, sits stiffly with little movement, no expression of feelings, serious absence of any humor, not a smile or grin, strictly business, no social skills whatsoever. Referred by his internist, Dr. Wood. Chief complaint. I am driven against my will by sexual impulses. Why now? Last straw, episode a week ago, which he described as though by rote. I arrived by plane in Chicago for a professional meeting, got off the plane and charged to the nearest phone and went down my list of women in Chicago looking for a sexual liaison that evening. No luck. They were all busy. Of course they were busy. It was a Friday evening. I knew I was coming to Chicago. I could have phoned them days, even weeks earlier. Then, after calling the last number in my book, I hung up the phone and said to myself, "Thank God. Now I can read and get a good night's sleep," which is what I really wanted to do all along. Patience says that phrase, that paradox, which is what I really wanted to do all along, haunted him all week and is the specific impetus for seeking therapy. "That's what I want to focus on in therapy," he says. "If that is what I want, to read and to get a good night's sleep, Dr. Hertzfeld, tell me, why can't I, why don't I do it?" Slowly, more details of his work with Philip Slate coasted into mind. Philip had intellectually intrigued him. At the time of their first meeting, he had been working on a paper on psychotherapy and the will, and Philip's question, "Why can't I do what I truly want to do?" was a fascinating beginning for the article. And most of all, he recalled Philip's extraordinary immutability. After 3 years, he seemed entirely untouched and unchanged, and as sexually driven as ever. Whatever became of Philip Slate? Not one word from him since he abruptly bailed out of therapy 22 years ago. Again, Julius wondered whether, without knowing it, he had been helpful to Philip. Suddenly he had to know. It seemed a matter of life and death. He reached for the phone and dialed 411. 2. Ecstasy in the act of copulation. That is it. That is the true essence and core of all things, the goal and purpose of all existence. "Hello, is this Philip Slate?" "Yes, Philip Slate here." "Dr. Hertzfeld here. Julius Hertzfeld." "Julius Hertzfeld?" A voice from your past. The deep past. The Pleistocene past. Julius Hertzfeld. I can't believe it. It must be, what, at least 20 years? And why this call? "Well, Philip, I'm calling about your bill. I don't believe you paid in full for our last session." "What? The last session? But I'm sure..." "Just kidding, Philip. Sorry. Some things never change. The old man is still jaunty and irrepressible. I'll be serious. Here, in a nutshell, is why I'm calling. I'm having some health problems. and I'm contemplating retirement. In the course of making this decision, I have developed an irresistible urge to meet with some of my ex-patients, just to do some follow-ups, satisfy my own curiosity. I'll explain more later if you wish. So, here's my question to you. Would you be willing to meet with me? Have a talk for an hour? Review our therapy together and fill me in on what's happened to you? It'll be interesting and enlightening for me. Who knows? Maybe for you as well. An hour. Sure. Why not? I assume there's no fee? Not unless you want to charge me, Philip. I'm asking for your time. How about later this week? Say, Friday afternoon? Friday? Fine, that's satisfactory. I'll give you an hour at 1 o'clock. I shan't request payment for my services, but this time let's meet in my office. I'm on Union Street, 431 Union, near Franklin. Look for my office number on the building directory. I'll be listed as Dr. Slate. I am now also a therapist. Julius shivered as he hung up the phone. He swiveled his chair around and craned his neck to catch a glimpse of the Golden Gate Bridge. After that call, he needed to see something beautiful and feel something warm in his hands. He filled up his meerschaum pipe with Balkan Sobrani, lit the match, and sucked. Oh, baby, Julius thought. That warm, earthy taste of Latakia, that honeyed, pungent fragrance, like nothing else in the world. Hard to believe that he'd been away from it for so many years. He sank into a reverie and mused about the day he stopped smoking. Had to be right after that visit to his dentist. His next-door neighbor, old Dr. Denbor, who had died 20 years ago. 20 years? How could it be? Julius could still see his long Dutch face and gold-rimmed spectacles so clearly. Old Dr. Denbor beneath the soil now for 20 years, and he, Julius, still above ground. For now. That blister on your palate, Dr. Denbor shook his head slightly. Looks worrisome. We'll need a biopsy. And though that biopsy had been negative, it caught Julius's attention because that very week he had gone to Al's funeral, his old cigarette-smoking tennis buddy, who died of lung cancer. And it didn't help then that he was in the midst of reading Freud, Living and Dying by Max Schur, Freud's doctor. A graphic account of how Freud's cigar-spawned cancer gradually devoured his palate, his jaw, and finally his life. Schur promised Freud to help him die when the time came. And when Freud finally told him the pain was so great that it no longer made sense to continue, Schur proved a man of his word and injected a fatal dose of morphine. Now that was a doctor. Where do you find a Dr. Schur nowadays? Over 20 years of no tobacco, and also no eggs or cheese or animal fats. Healthy and happily abstinent. Until that goddamn physical exam. Now everything was permitted. Smoking, ice cream, spare ribs, eggs, cheese, everything. What difference did any of that matter any longer? What difference did anything make? In another year, Julius Hertzfeld would be leached into the soil, his molecules scattered, awaiting their next assignment. And sooner or later, in another few million years, the whole solar system would lie in ruins. Feeling the curtain of despair descending, Julius quickly distracted himself by turning his attention back to his phone call with Philip Slate. Philip? A therapist? How was that possible? He remembered Philip as cold, uncaring, oblivious of others, and judging from that phone call, he was still much the same. Julius drew in his pipe and shook his head in silent wonder as he opened Philip's chart and continued reading his dictated note of their first session. Present illness. sexually driven since 13, compulsive masturbation throughout adolescence continuing till present day, sometimes 4-5 times daily, obsessed with sex continually masturbates to give himself peace. Huge hunk of life spent on obsessing about sex. He says, the time I've wasted chasing women, I could have gotten PhDs in philosophy, Mandarin Chinese, and astrophysics. Relationships. A loner. Lives with his dog in a small flat. No male friends. Zero. Nor any contacts with acquaintances from past, from high school, college, grad school. Extraordinarily isolated. Never had a long-term relationship with a woman. Consciously avoids ongoing relationships. Prefers one-night stands. Occasionally sees a woman as long as a month. Usually woman breaks it off. Either she wants more from him, or she gets angry at being used, or gets upset about his seeing other women. Desires novelty. Wants the sexual chase, but never satiated. Sometimes when he travels, he picks up a woman, has sex, gets rid of her, and an hour later leaves his hotel room on the prowl again. Keeps a record of partners, a score sheet. And in past 12 months has had sex with 90 different women. Tells all this with flat affect. No shame, no boasting. Feels anxious if he's alone for an evening. Usually sex acts like Valium. Once he has sex, he feels peaceful for the rest of the evening and can read comfortably. No homosexual activities or fantasies. His perfect evening? Out early. Picks up woman in bar. Gets laid, preferably before dinner. Dumps woman as quickly as possible, preferably without having to buy her dinner, but usually ends up having to feed her. Important to have as much evening time as possible for reading before going to bed. No TV, no movies, no social life, no sports. Only recreation is reading and classical music. Voracious reader of classics, history, and philosophy. No fiction, nothing current. Wanted to talk about Zeno and Aristarchus, his current interests. Past history. Grew up in Connecticut, only child, upper middle class. Father investment banker who committed suicide when Philip was 13. He knows nothing about circumstances or reasons behind father's suicide. Some vague ideas that it was aggravated by mother's continual criticism. Blanket childhood amnesia. Remembers little of his first several years and nothing about his father's funeral. Mother remarried when he was 24. A loner in school, fanatically immersed in studies, never had close friends, and since starting Yale at 17, has cut himself off from family. Phone contact with mother once or twice a year. Has never met stepfather. Work. Successful chemist. Develops new hormonal-based pesticides for DuPont. Strictly an 8-to-5 job. No passion about field. Recently growing bored with his work. Keeps current with the research and field, but never during his off hours. High income plus valuable stock options. A hoarder. Enjoys tabulating his assets and managing his investments and spends every lunch hour alone, studying stock market research. Impression. Schizoid. Sexually compulsive. Very distant. Refused to look at me. Not once did he meet my gaze. No sense of anything personal between us. Clueless about interpersonal relations. Responded to my here-and-now question about his first impressions of me with a look of bewilderment, as though I was speaking Catalan or Swahili. He seemed edgy, and I felt uncomfortable with him. Absolutely no humor. Zero. Highly intelligent. Articulate but stingy with words. Makes me work hard. Tenaciously concerned about therapy cost, though he can easily afford it. Requested fee reduction, which I refused. Seemed unhappy about my starting a couple minutes late and did not hesitate to inquire whether we'd make up this time at end of session to get full value. Questioned me twice about precisely how much advance notice he needed to give to cancel a session and avoid being charged. closing the chart, Julius thought. Now, 25 years later, Philip is a therapist. Could there be a more unsuitable person in the world for that job? He seems very much the same, still no sense of humor, still hung up about money. Maybe I shouldn't have made that crack about his bill. A therapist without a sense of humor? And so cold. And that edgy request to meet at his office. Julius shivered again. 3. Life is a miserable thing. I have decided to spend my life thinking about it. Union Street was sunny and festive. The clatter of silverware and the buzz of animated luncheon conversations streamed from the packed sidewalk tables at Prego, Beetlenut, Exotic Pizza, and Perry's. Aquamarine and magenta balloons tethered to parking meters advertised a weekend sidewalk sale. But as Julius strolled toward Philip's office, he barely glanced at the diners or the outdoor stalls heaped with the leftover designer clothes from the summer season. Nor did he linger at any of his favorite shop windows. Not at Marita's antique Japanese furniture shop, the Tibetan shop, or even Asian treasures with the gaily colored 18th-century roof tile of a fantastical woman warrior that he rarely passed without admiring. Nor was dying in his mind. The riddles connected with Philip's slate offered diversion from those disquieting thoughts. First, there was the riddle of memory, and why he could so easily conjure up Philip's image with such eerie clarity. Where had Philip's face, name, story been lurking all these years? Hard to get his mind around the fact that the memory of his whole experience with Philip was contained neurochemically somewhere in the cortex of his brain. Most likely Philip dwelled in an intricate Philip network of connected neurons that, when triggered by the right neurotransmitters, would spring into action and project an image of Philip upon a ghostly screen in his visual cortex. He found it chilling to think of harboring a microscopic robotic projectionist in his brain. But even more intriguing was the riddle of why he chose to revisit Philip. Of all his old patients, why choose Philip to lift out of deep memory storage? Was it simply because his therapy had been so dismally unsuccessful? Surely there was more to it than that. After all, there were many other patients he had not helped. But most of the faces and names of the failures had vanished without a trace. Maybe it was because most of his failures had dropped out of therapy quickly. Philip was an unusual failure, and that he had continued to come. God, how he continued. For 3 frustrating years, he never missed a session. Never late, not 1 minute. Too cheap to waste any paid time. And then one day, without warning, a simple and irrevocable announcement at the end of an hour that this was his last session. Even when Philip terminated, Julius had still regarded him as treatable. But then he always erred in the direction of thinking everyone was treatable. Why did he fail? Philip was serious about working on his problems. He was challenging, smart, with intelligence to burn, but thoroughly unlikable. Julius rarely accepted a patient he disliked, but he knew there was nothing personal in his dislike of Philip. Anyone would dislike him. Consider his lifelong lack of friends. Though he may have disliked Philip, he loved the intellectual riddle Philip presented. His chief complaint, why can't I do what I really want to do, was an enticing example of will paralysis. Though the therapy may not have been useful for Philip, it was marvelously facilitative for Julius's writing, and many ideas emerging from the sessions found their way into his celebrated article, The Therapist and the Will, and into his book, Wishing, Willing, and Acting. The thought flashed through his mind that perhaps he had exploited Philip. Perhaps now, with his heightened sense of connectivity, he might redeem himself, might yet accomplish what he had failed to do before. 431 Union was a modest stucco two-story corner building. In the vestibule, Julius